The state's vaccine administration rate shows some signs of hesitancy. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Monday, it's April 26th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we look at variants detected in South Dakota and how those numbers might intersect with our advancement toward herd immunity. Are we leaving ourselves open to a new surge of even deadlier COVID cases? Dr. Shankar Kura is with us. We look at our changing understanding of the reproductive life of women in light of a new study. We talk about the difficult career of South Dakota's first governor, Arthur Millette, on Images of the Past. Plus, we preview new music from Judd Hoos and the band's upcoming tour. We'll talk about that later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Lawmakers and the governor's office are still undecided about calling a special session before a voter-approved medical marijuana law goes into effect. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Leaders in the House and the governor's office want to make some changes to Initiative Measure 26, the medical marijuana law. There is less support for those changes in the Senate, where leaders say they will only consider non-controversial administrative rules. Spencer Gosch is the Speaker of the Republican-controlled House.
It seems likely that we will not be having a special session in June at this point.
Governor Noem wants to add some detail to the law. Noem would set a maximum of 3 plants allowed in the home of someone approved to use medical cannabis. The governor wants to prohibit those under 21 from inhaling marijuana, and she would clarify the Department of Health's rulemaking authority. Governor Noem also wants legislators to take up a bill that she says would protect fairness in women's sports. Critics say the legislation targets the state's transgender population. Noem also wants lawmakers to decide how to spend $1.4 billion in federal coronavirus relief money. As for the likelihood of a special session this spring, Governor Noem says there's currently nothing she can confirm.
I know they're having some debates between legislative leadership teams on what they'd like to see, and you know, my staff and I are continuing to communicate with them to see what can be accomplished.
Noem issued 2 executive orders after the legislature failed to uphold her version of the women's sports bill. The voter-approved Initiative Measure 26, legalizing medical marijuana, is set to go in effect on July 1st. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Plans for a Native American-hosted community center were announced in Rapid City. The proposed HESAPA OTP Center is being planned around an approved land exchange resolution with Rapid City officials. SDPB's David Ozzetti Scott reports.
A community center was identified as a top priority within the city's Native American community. The center is still in the early stages of planning, but officials in the HESAPA OTP organization hope to have the facility approved and completed in the next 5 years. Chante Hart is a community organizer and on the board of directors for the proposed community center. She sees the center as a place of understanding for the whole community.
It's a place for us to reconnect with Native and non-Native people so that we can teach them our traditions and that we can carry on our legacy to our children. And so right now we're looking for the support of our community. We want all voices at the table. We want the input from our community. We are in the vision planning stages of our community center, and we can't do this without the voices of our community.
Hart wants a place where Rapid City's community can come together and carry on the Lakota legacy. The community center would need between 30 and 50,000 square feet of space to meet their needs. Bev Warren is a member of the board for the community center and a respected community elder. She grew up learning traditional Lakota values and wants to pass those values to the next generation.
Our values need to be kept alive and well by our example and by our teaching of the youth. The youth will have a place to come. We hopefully will have an industrial-sized kitchen where we can serve food to the children after school.
Warren says their children need that connection to their community and culture. She says a community center is an important part of keeping Lakota children engaged in education without losing touch with their traditions. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm David Ozzetti Scott in Rapid City.
For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Traffic in South Dakota is picking up, and it's not unusual to encounter drivers who seem, how shall we say it, out of practice from a year of driving less. Well, this is National Work Zone Awareness Week, and joining us with a reminder to slow down through those South Dakota work zones, we welcome Craig Smith. He's Director of Operations for the South Dakota Department of Transportation. Craig Smith, welcome back to The Moment. Thanks for being here.
All right. Thank you for having me.
I think everybody that I know and is talking about being on the road in the city of Sioux Falls or the state of South Dakota and has a complaint about how people are driving right now. And it seems like people forgot how to drive when they drove a little bit less in 2020. This is National Work Zone Awareness Week. Tell us a little bit about what some of the risks are to our road and highway workers.
You know, and it isn't just the highway workers. It's really to both those drivers going through the work zones and obviously our contractors and DOT staff there on the projects. But, you know, what we see, one of the biggest contributors is speed and distracted driving as people are going through the work zones. And obviously speed, I think, speaks for itself. Going through there too fast creates problems. But the distracted part, whether it's your phone or just what's going on the projects, you really do need to take some heightened awareness as you enter those work zones. Every work zone's a little bit different. You can't really anticipate what to expect. You need to pay attention and be aware within those work zones what's going on.
Tell us how big of a problem it is.
Excuse me?
Tell us how big of a problem it is. Many fatalities throughout the year, many injuries, crashes. What do we know statistically?
There is. And nationwide, it's somewhere around 840 work zone fatalities. But right here in South Dakota, we see 2 to 3 fatalities, around 9 or 10 serious injury crashes, as well as about 180 to 200 crashes within our work zone. So it isn't just a matter of having a fender bender, that it really is can be quite dangerous and really a catastrophe in some of these work zone crashes that we see.
Yeah, I have a friend whose son, a young college-age student, was hit by a truck when he was out working in one of these work zones, and it has forever altered his life. Do you have similar experiences where you know people who, you know, have lost a family member or who have had to go through some major, you know, medical trauma and care because of the severity of the crashes?
Yeah, I mean, just with, like you mentioned, the workers, we've certainly had some workers that have sustained some injuries within the work zones. Fortunately, I've not been involved in one's fatalities, but with the drivers and that, we do see very serious crashes. You know, our state highways, we tend to be at higher speeds when we're working on interstates and highways, and that's where we tend to see that really the big issue is when people are driving through these work zones too fast.
Mm. All right. Tell us a little bit about Wednesday, because it is Go Orange Day. What is that?
Yeah, so Go Orange Day, we're trying to, and this week in general, we're trying to bring awareness to work zones and the things drivers need to be aware of. But we're encouraging people to wear orange that day to bring some awareness, and not only to the workers, but just to drivers, that as you go through work zones, be aware, don't be distracted, pay attention, and slow down.
Tell us a little bit about consequences. What can you tell us about the punishments for going too fast or driving through these work zones distracted? Fines go up, I'm assuming?
Yeah, they're certainly in all of the work zones. They are signed accordingly for that, where the fines are doubled. A lot of our work zones, we do have reduced enforceable speed limits, and we work closely both with the State Highway Patrol as well as locals to do speed enforcement. So there can be those consequences as well for drivers. We would like to think people are going to be aware and slow down just for the safety of themselves and the workers out there. But we do use the speed limit enforcement to encourage people to comply.
So most of us think of distraction as drivers on their cell phones or looking down at their radio or, you know, dealing with their kids in the car. But you mentioned also the distraction of the project itself. Tell me a little bit about how some people get distracted just by the kind of work that's happening around them, and how can they focus on navigating that work zone without slowing down the whole process?
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, the projects are, there's some pretty neat things going on in there. There's sometimes some pretty large equipment, some things people haven't seen before, a lot of activity going on. And it's not just what's going on in the closed areas. We do have trucks and equipment that need to enter traffic, so a lot of things to be distracted as you drive through. But really, drivers, whether you're in a work zone or otherwise, just need to be looking forward, slowing down, paying attention to the car in front of them. One of the biggest contributors we see are those rear end collisions within work zones where someone's not paying attention, or maybe the car in front of them needs to slow down suddenly, and then a rear end accident or crash happens.
Yeah. Well, it is National Work Zone Awareness Week. Wednesday is a day to wear orange and raise awareness for those workers and the fellow drivers. Slow down, take it easy, pay attention. Craig Smith, Director of Operations for the South Dakota Department of Transportation, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next on In the Moment, changing notions about the reproductive life of women. A new study from the Journal of American Medical Association is out. We'll have more on that in a minute on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, investigative reporter Michael Moss. His bestseller, Salt, Sugar, Fat, explored food companies' aggressive marketing of highly processed, unhealthy foods. His new book examines the addictive properties of processed foods and the food giants' efforts to keep us eating them. It's called Hooked. Join us.
Monday at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
Thank you to those that gave to SDPB during the Sound Vision Campaign radio drive. Your gift will help create events, tell stories, and build community. You play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. There's still time to give. The more people that come together to support SDPB, the more SDPB can do. Give at sdpb.org/donate.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, for decades, doctors have told women they have, on average, 35 reproductive years. It's been a distinction that has colored the way we view our so-called biological clocks. Now, a new report from the Journal of American Medical Association reveals a shift in the reproductive lives of women. Dr. Abria Rourke is an OBGYN with Sanford Health and joins us now for insight. Dr. Rourke, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with this idea of how big of news this report from JAMA was. Was it a surprise for people? Put it into context for us first.
I mean, I think that it's probably the first research-based article that has shown this data as opposed to something that we've been seeing anecdotally or clinically probably for the last number of years sort of thing. So I think it is bringing to the forefront some natural trends that we have seen over the last, 10 to 15 years.
What are some of the key takeaways from the report itself? More than 35 years on average now.
Yes, I think it's interesting, some of the things about menarche starting earlier and then again a transition later to menopause, some of those things that we would see with an increase, just this being the first or second generation of women who've been on some sort of hormonal contraception, I think has driven some of that later age, just because those ovaries being shut down for a period of time on like a contraceptive option, which some of us have seen a change, whereas like those ovaries maybe were dormant for a little bit longer, again, once those women come off of that hormonal contraception in order to conceive, pushing that natural ovary time to later in life.
Yeah. Does that also tie in with how many children women are having or how many years of their lives they spend pregnant?
So, I mean, and I think in this part of the country, women families tend to be bigger than we see on the coast. So I still feel like we're still seeing several patients still having kids like in their early to mid-20s sort of thing. But I have at least, I mean, right now, four or five women pregnant over the age of 40. So I do think if you look at the trend, we're definitely seeing it push more from like the early to mid-20s to more even, you know, early to late 30s.
All right. So you heard me gasp there about over 40. And that's but let's talk about that, because in some ways, you know, that's a stigma, the sense that you didn't have until your 40s to have children. And you thought you were maybe a little bit safer if you didn't want to have children in your 40s. So tell us a little bit about the stigma and the fear that women have of waiting too long because they fear for their health or the health of their babies. And then also the sense that they thought and become a little more casual about their reproductive health as they get older, because we work on this social assumption that it doesn't apply to us anymore.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I mean, women who come to my office for annual exams or that sort of thing, we definitely talk about periods, because I tell them in your 40s, it's not impossible to get pregnant.
Yeah.
50 is, I tell them, like, you know, it'd be reasonable to stop your contraception and for us to see kind of like if we're headed towards menopause. That I think is reasonable. Also, I mean, I think a lot more women are having it, and they're having that discussion with us about like what, you know, what our medical recommendations are on when we, you know, when do we think it's safe? Now, I do think, I mean, ACOG hasn't changed their, I mean, again, this article is fairly recent, but ACOG hasn't changed their stance on like advanced maternal age still being 35. But I tell patients, I think, you know, 35 to 40, we're still seeing, you know, those babies a lot less genetic abnormalities than I think the general population would expect to see. I think they think, you know, like you said, over, you know, over 35 or certainly over 40. I do think that the risk of pregnancy in general increases as women's age increases, particularly over 40. But I think it's not quite as dangerous, I think, as previously thought.
How about the beginning of girls' periods? You mentioned that earlier. Let's go back to that. Are we seeing a change in how old our girls are when they start their reproductive lives?
I do think there has been a slight trend, maybe less trend on the front end, like maybe not quite as low as menopause has become later sort of thing. But I think some of those changes, you know, depend on ethnicity, because we know that African-American girls will start their period before Caucasian girls. So in this part of the country, we don't see as much of that. But I do think, I mean, you know, some papers out there would say just, again, with diet changes, you know, some of the, there's some discussion about like some of the hormones and some of the foods we consume here has that pushed that pubertal thing a little bit earlier, just given like the consumption of some of those things.
Yeah. Is that true? Is that scientifically valid that hormones in, you know, milk or processed food is making girls get their periods sooner?
I haven't seen a study, but I haven't seen a study that says that that can be a causative agent, but I have had a discussion with several patients about that.
Yeah, that is the concern. So what do women need to know from, other than, you know, planning their families or planning their reproductive health, what do they need to know about this as it might intersect with other things like cancer risks or things such as that, other health issues? Does it at all?
Yes. Well, I think like when we talk about those ovaries and menopause, we think that those ovaries, I tell my patients, even in menopause, we think those ovaries have benefits for cardiac protection and bone protection well into menopause age. So given that, you know, heart disease is the number one killer for women, I don't think the study addresses that, but like, will, you know, will that provide a little bit more protection longer in women's lives? I also tell women that when we start talking about family planning and that sort of thing, I'm like, if you have regular cycles, we're not to menopause yet. We're not to perimenopause. I tell them it's similar to when girls start their period. It starts very irregular. Women can get irregular. But yes, that menopause is very much in the rear sort of thing, where, you know, 12 months of no bleeding sort of thing. Mm. I do think, I mean, outside of breast cancer, if you talk about GYN cancers, by far our most common is endometrial cancer. And we worry about any sort of bleeding after menopause, but the thing I tell my patients, like, the thing we need to rule out is a cancer of the uterus. So going forward, you know, as women age, sort of thing, well, we have to work up like abnormal uterine bleeding a little bit more aggressively, a little bit less aggressively, thinking, oh, she's not menopausal yet, this bleeding could very well be normal. I also tell women, it'll be interesting because usually I have this conversation about women tend to do what their moms did, you know, like, when did your mom go through menopause? But now it may, given this study and a couple of generations, that may not be the case. We may not be able to counsel patients about like that anymore.
Right, right. And I just want to close with this idea that we were talking about this last week. And, you know, my grandmother, you didn't even talk about this. And here we are talking about on the radio, we're talking about periods, and we're talking about reproductive health and infertility and things like that. How important is it, Dr. Rourke, to have open conversations about what is essentially a key component of women's health and quality of life?
Yes, I think obviously it's something that we do all day long, every day, so we feel really comfortable with it. But I encourage patients to, you know, the infertility talk, the miscarriage, you know, discussion. I'm like, even if you're, and I do think it's better now than it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. But I was like, likely someone in your social group has struggled with one of these things, sort of thing. And my daughter's 10, and we've had the period discussion, and I just want it to be like a normal thing for women. There's nothing wrong with them. If they can't get pregnant, there's nothing, you know, there's not something they did, but that to have a discussion with their doctor and to know that there's other people struggling with that as well.
Yeah. Other people curious, other people wanting to have the conversation. Dr. Rourke, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Abria Rourke is an OBGYN with Sanford Health. Up next on In the Moment, we keep the healthcare conversation going, this time with COVID-19. Dr. Shankar Kura is with us for an update. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
When composer Jia Lee arrived at the Berklee College of Music, the South Korean native had no jazz background, but she wanted to be a composer. And despite being unfamiliar with Count Basie or Gil Evans, she studied jazz composition and rapidly absorbed the language. 10 years later, she's a masterful big band leader and composer. I'm Carl Gerke, and on the next Jazz Nightly New Music Monday, we'll sample her latest album, Daring Mind. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by ReliaBank, personal and business banking solutions, reliable services, and a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank, a brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hey, it's Rachel Martin. There are certain things you can always count on. The sun rises and sets, the clocks change come springtime, the weekend never feels quite long enough. Like clockwork, you can rely on Morning Edition from NPR News to bring you trustworthy journalism and keep you connected with your community. Listen every weekday.
Join us weekdays at 5 a.m. Central and weekends at 7 a.m. Central on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The P1 variant of the coronavirus has been detected in South Dakota. Meanwhile, the state is starting to see a statistical slowdown in the pace of vaccine administration. What happens next as we continue to battle a deadly contagion? Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, and he joins us for our weekly COVID-19 update. Dr. Kura, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Lori, thank you for having me.
Explain to people what we're seeing in the pace of vaccines administered. Some of it, I'm sure, is expected as we move through vulnerable populations and older people who have been, very compliant and excited to get the vaccine. But are we seeing it slow down now? How much and what does that mean?
Great question, Lori. Yes, unfortunately, we are seeing a slowdown. If you look at the week over week, there's a 25% decline in people signing up or registering or getting vaccinated. And that is clearly playing out in the demographics you just mentioned, those below the age of 60. So we're talking ages 25 on all the way up to 55, those folks, now that phase two is available, in other words, anyone can just go get a vaccine, there's a significant reluctance, hesitation, or even maybe a, decreased interest in getting vaccinated.
Yeah, I was going to say apathy. There's a sense from some people that I've been talking to that, well, I've made it this far and so many people are vaccinated and I go to the restaurant, I can't tell the difference. I don't have time for that. Explain why you should make time to get your vaccine if you have not yet been vaccinated.
Yes, very important to get vaccinated. We are not past the pandemic. We're only past that if we get to at least 80% of our community vaccinated. As long as we have about roughly right now, I would say 40% of our population still vulnerable to the disease, that acts as a reservoir. This 40% of folks are going to be the, kind of a wave of, new cases, hospitalizations, and unfortunately even deaths. This is not unusual. If you look at the history of vaccines, since the 50s, we've very successfully developed vaccines that we have a childhood series of about 14 or so vaccines that prevent all these deadly infectious diseases. Infections still are the reason why people die more than anything else. And to prevent infections, the best way is vaccination. And what happens is once we've conquered those pediatric illnesses like measles, mumps, rubella, and all these other Haemophilus influenzae, all these things that can cause severe meningitis, severe damage to your internal organs, we don't see those deaths anymore. But what people forget when you have, nobody talking about measles, they'll say, well, we have conquered it. We don't need to vaccinate some of them. And thankfully, not everyone does that. And the same is happening with COVID-19 vaccines. People are saying, hey, the numbers are down. I'm not worried about myself. And this is being played again. And a good example historically for the United States has been the polio vaccine, where Jonas Salk came up with a brilliant vaccine, a modern miracle. And all of a sudden, we could get rid of polio. But it didn't happen as quickly as that. In fact, we got the youngest, families were able to get the youngest kids to get the vaccine, but the teenagers and the younger folks felt like they're not vulnerable and therefore didn't volunteer. And a series of things happened that made it possible for teens across this nation to sign up and get vaccinated. Number one, you had celebrities like Elvis Presley going on TV to show that he will take that vaccine. Additionally, there were groups formed, teens against polio. And that's how this was done. And they were actually historical facts that people, teenagers, were not allowed to come to dance clubs or places where they go to dance unless they could show that they were immunized against polio. And those are the kind of efforts that will take because people, again, will say, well, there are not enough cases around. I don't need to get vaccinated.
Yeah. Talk about, if you would, help us understand variants that haven't been, I'm trying to get at this idea when you think of a 40%, reservoir of people who say, I'm choosing not to get vaccinated because this disease is just not that, I'm not worried about it. It's not a high risk to me personally. Could those people end up as sort of patient zero of a new variant, right here in South Dakota that is even deadlier and impacts younger people more? Help us understand how variants work and what the risks are, even to the people who think that they're not vulnerable to the novel coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2 that we first saw, before it continues to adapt and change.
Absolutely. You make a great point. If you look at the spread of variants, and you always remember, people always say the United Kingdom variant, but what we are seeing is, yes, there's a United Kingdom variant, the South African and the Brazilian variant, which have been reported here in South Dakota. But we're beginning to see there are two New York variants and there are two California variants that are also rising in numbers. And these are clearly an example of cases that occurred because people were not vaccinated. And every time this 40% reservoir of folks that are slow to vaccinate are available for the virus to enter their bodies and then multiply, it has a high likelihood of new variants emerging. And that's the threat, and that's the race we're against, is if we can vaccinate up to 80% of our community, and this is a true race against time and against the virus is continuing to find new bodies to enter that have not been vaccinated, and therefore be able to multiply in large numbers and then develop these mutations or variants that can be, at one point or the other, rise to the level of, you know, being able to evade our vaccines. And that would be tragic. So our success will depend entirely on this race to get 80% of our folks vaccinated. So it's very important. The more reluctant we are giving the virus a chance to form a new variant. And that's really the race we're against.
Yeah, and that could affect the more than 50% of South Dakotans who have already said yes to the vaccine as well, couldn't it? It doesn't just impact the people who are currently unvaccinated, potentially.
Correct, correct. And that's a good point. Those, the 60% that are vaccinated are only protected against the COVID, current variants were protected against all of those, but theoretically, and very likely, if we continue to not vaccinate most of our folks, there can be variants that develop that can then escape our immune system that has been designed by these vaccines to, at this point at least, cover all the variants. We know that that's why we say get vaccinated. Our vaccines still work, and the more we can get vaccinated, the less likely a variant will emerge that will escape and therefore even infect the ones that are already protected by the vaccine.
You talk to people, I mean, you've been with us since the pandemic has been part of our daily lives in South Dakota. We're not the only ones. You're out there everywhere telling this story. What do people not get?
I think it's we've studied this well. Populations tend to respond to infections and, you know, by getting vaccinated. Then you have the first 10 years of vaccination is very successful. And then you enter a phase, the next 10 years, where people say, well, I don't see measles around. You know, there'll be small pockets of folks who will believe that vaccines are not the reason why measles is not around. And then tend to believe that since there are no numbers and no deaths annually reported, I don't need the vaccine. And this is where we've seen even measles reemerge in small communities that decide not to vaccinate their children. And this is kind of the same phenomenon at a smaller scale, at a smaller timeline. All of a sudden, the people who are vulnerable got the vaccine, and those who believe they're not are saying, well, I don't see the numbers. They're not, it's not a rising numbers. I don't need to get vaccinated. And this is a fallacy, and it's very hard to get past that. The best way to do that is, you know, to influence folks, send a message that you should protect yourself, and maybe other things like schools and universities taking a step forward and saying, if you're going to enroll in our colleges, then you need to get vaccinated.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit later in this hour about an upcoming event in Spearfish. It's a charity concert with Judd Hoos, and it's sponsored by Monument Health. And help me understand the role of large events like that, and how do you explain to people it's time to do some things that feel very normal, and yet is it a good idea to gather in a concert setting at this point, especially sponsored by a healthcare organization?
Yeah, good point. Again, the important thing for us to message, which we've been trying really hard, is we have enough vaccine supplies. There's never a question, and which is why all 50 states are saying anyone can get vaccinated. If we can get more people vaccinated, we can return to a normal. And we want people to use that as a driving force, an incentive to get vaccinated. Short of that, you know, at this point, if you can see the declining numbers, 25% decrease from last week of people willing to get vaccinated, we have very little else to incentivize folks other than saying you can return to a normal if you all get vaccinated. And there's a huge effort nationally and statewide. All healthcare organizations are participating in trying to get that message across to get folks to get in line, get vaccinated.
Let's talk about the Johnson & Johnson shot, because I believe that is up and running again in the state of South Dakota. The FDA said move forward. Tell me a little bit about people who are making their appointment and hoping for that one-and-done shot, but now they have also heard that this vaccine was paused for some time because of some concerns. Help us understand how to think about that. Yeah.
Yeah, great news that, you know, the pause has been lifted. And the pause was precautionary, and the data and the evidence is strongly that the risks are very, very minimal. I would say that I'm grateful that that's returned back, because a lot of folks want to just get one, like you said, one and done. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine has a very low risk, and if we really measure that risk, it's much lower than many of the common conditions that we see medically, and folks that you know, also have habits like cigarette smoking that, you know, actually have a higher risk of clot formation. We don't talk about those, but when you measure this, it's less than one in a million versus you know, much higher rates. Even with COVID-19, it's 16% risk of forming those very same clots that you can prevent by getting this vaccine, where the rate of occurrence of this rare clot is 0.000001%. So you're really, really better off taking the vaccine. And so far, at least in South Dakota, we have not reported any cases of this clot and conditions of rare clots.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about the effectiveness and how long the effectiveness for the or the efficacy of the vaccine works? What are we learning, as some people in the clinical studies have been vaccinated for quite some time now?
Yes, we know at least 8 months, and we can almost, based on the best evidence we have, and this is based not just on antibody levels, it's also looking at T cells, which are very, very important response, and these usually last longer. The best evidence here is anywhere from 2 to 10 years that you will have a protective immunity from the T and B cell responses. And this is borne out in real world from this first SARS virus, which is also a coronavirus, very similar to this one, in 2003. And those folks, 17 years later, still have robust immunity to the coronavirus from that first SARS.
Dr. Shankar-Kura, always a pleasure to talk to you and continue this story. And I look forward to the day when we have nothing to talk about. I don't think that day is soon.
The summer is coming, and I think we will get there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kura. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lori.
Well, this week in 2005, and following input from around the state, Governor Mike Rounds recommended the images that appear on South Dakota's commemorative quarter. Paired on the tail side of the coin, the faces of Mount Rushmore and an image of a pheasant. Launched in 1999, the United States Mint's 50 State Quarters program was a 10-year initiative that honored each of the nation states in the order that they ratified the Constitution or were admitted into the Union. Each quarter was produced for about 10 weeks with the intention they would never be produced again. In a departure from the standard quarter and to accommodate state designs, the words United States of America, quarter dollar, liberty, and In God We Trust all appear on the heads side of the commemorative quarters. On the state design side of our quarter are the inscriptions South Dakota, 1889, 2006 for the year minted, and E Pluribus Unum, which means out of many, one. The South Dakota commemorative quarter was designed by Michael Lytle. John Mercanti did the engraving, and the coins were struck at the mints in Denver and in Philadelphia. Though the South Dakota quarter was not put into circulation until November of 2006, those images approved by Governor Rounds this week, 16 years ago, in 2005. Up next on In the Moment, we go to images of the past and talk about South Dakota's first governor and his troubled career. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
Mm-hmm. I'm Peter O'Dowd. Volunteers in the Saguaro National Park are on a mission to save the most iconic cactus in the Southwest, where invasive buffelgrass is turning the Sonoran Desert into a tinderbox.
Many of the young saguaros die in a fire, so if we let buffelgrass just fill this in, we're going to lose saguaros.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City, offering a broad range of insurance products to protect you and your family at every stage of life. GeneHufford.com.
In Arizona, aid groups are warning of a growing humanitarian crisis as the surge of unauthorized migrants apprehended at the border continues.
We are oftentimes some of the first friendly faces that they'll see here on the U.S. side of the border, because prior to this, they've been in government detention.
How nonprofits are struggling to provide relief as they await federal funding. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB. Underwriting SDPB Radio enhances your corporate image and projects quality and credibility. Stand out from the competition and reach a quality audience. Include SDPB Radio in your branding campaign. SDPB.org/support.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota's first governor, Arthur Millette, enjoyed a successful but very difficult political career. Terrible economic conditions during Millette's time in office, coupled with a theft from the state treasury, and the scandal that followed took a devastating toll on his fortune and his career. For today's Images of the Past, we're joined by Gary Enright. Gary is director of the 1881 Courthouse Museum in Custer. Gary Enright, welcome back to In the Moment.
Well, thank you, Laurie. I appreciate it. It's fun to be back with you again.
We have been having a really fascinating time talking about these Civil War veterans on Images of the Past and how they came to Dakota Territory and found a new place to be here. And Arthur Millette is one of those war veterans. What do you want to tell us to start out with about his time in office?
Well, the first thing is he was a native of Indiana, born and raised on a farm in Indiana in 1843. And his parents saw to it that he got a college degree. That was kind of rare back in those days, but he managed to get a degree, and he started out within weeks after graduating. He became a county superintendent of schools, and that was the way his life was for most of it. He just simply was a very active person in all of the communities, and he had a lot of very interesting things going on in his life. He was, when 1860 came along and the Civil War was going on, because he had a degree in law, he was chosen by the Army to be a man who comes in and trains the officers as to how to be officers. And that was how he did it. And he spent 4 years, all during the whole Civil War, teaching soldiers to be soldiers and teach them to be officers.
And he does a lot of writing in his diary about life in the Civil War, about being sick, about being cold, about being hot, about being wet, about being bored. How unusual is it to really have that kind of a record of day-to-day life for somebody in his position? It's a treasure trove, really.
It's really rare because most people didn't keep diaries of those kinds. And I think what he did was that he was trying to, maybe occupy a very active mind by simply keeping a log of what was going on every day. I really believe that he was very serious about it, and it was an unusual appointment because there weren't too many people who had law degrees that went into the military and were placed into a position of making sure that our officers in the military were well trained, and this is one of the things that he did. And I suppose he just liked to keep track of things, and so he, if the temperature was hot, he wrote about it.
How does he end up in Dakota Territory with his family, and how does he end up in politics?
Yeah, well, and he started out after the Civil War in 1875 was over. He got a job offer from a little office in Springfield, South Dakota, which is the far southeastern corner. Mm-hmm. And he decided he was going to practice law and do this kind of work in the territory of Dakota. And we were a long ways from being a state at that point in time. And so what happened was that he got to be got appointed to the Federal Land Agency in that part of Dakota Territory, and then he just sort of moved up in the place where he was working, and then he was hired by the community of Watertown, and he became the federal land agent there, and that was the big territory up in the northeastern part of South Dakota. And apparently he was a very bright guy. Yeah. And he managed to put together a program for the federal government that really led to the Dakotas becoming territories first and then become states. And that was his goal.
So he is known and remembered by his the people who lived in his time as an honest man. But when the state treasurer in 1895 steals most of the money in the state treasury and runs to South America, it's Governor Millett who tries to compensate by selling his home and his land and trying to make it right. What kind of a toll did this this crisis, this scandal, take on Millett's health?
Well, what he did was, in fact, followed up as soon as it became known to him that this money had been stolen by the state treasurer, or by the term was at that time, was the Dakota Territory treasurer. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the figure on how many thousands of dollars, but it was considerable amount of money. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of this, all of this time that these things are going on, he was working toward statehood for the Dakota Territory. And that's where he was involved and was appointed to be the sort of governor of the territory that was in both North Dakota and South Dakota. Yeah. And then he, once he got his influence on the President of the United States to make North Dakota and South Dakota legitimate states, full-dress states, and then that happened on February 22nd of 1889, South Dakota, yeah, Montana, Washington, and North Dakota were all appointed on the same day, the 22nd of February. So if you want another list for your calendar, that's another historical day in South Dakota.
I'm going to jump in here, Gary, and just let people know that they can learn more about this on our website as we do this wonderful series about Civil War soldiers who moved to Dakota Territory and kind of laid a groundwork that we still see the legacy of today and these stories that we still share today. And you can find more at sdpb.org/Civil War. Gary Enright, it is always a delight to hear your voice and to talk with you again. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Thanks, Lori.
The summer music festival scene is starting to take shape across the state. Monument Health presents the Judd Hoos Charity Jam. It's an all-day event. It's coming up on Saturday, June 5th at the Lyle Hare Stadium at Black Hill State University in Spearfish. That event is headlined by Nashville band The Wild Feathers. And joining us today with new music and details of that event and the band's upcoming tour, we welcome Judd Hoos guitarist Andy Young. Andy, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, new music coming out from Judd Hoos. Tell us a little bit about 2020 and the process of sort of dealing with how the world changed so quickly and also making new music.
Absolutely. Things did change in such a hurry for everybody, and especially the music industry. So we just kind of decided to take it upon ourselves to use the time off the road and be as productive and positive as we possibly could. So we ended up going to Nashville, traveling down there in October safely, and working with our producer, Jay Hall, down there, put together a new record, and we're coming out with it on June 4th, actually. It's titled Not Alone.
Not Alone. How were some of the conversations and sort of being in that bubble, and how did that influence the music that ends up on Not Alone?
There are definitely songs on there. A lot of the content, you know, it kind of reflects some of the frustrations of not being able to operate the way that we want to. But, you know, again, like I said, we try to use this time to be as positive and productive as possible. And, you know, we're coming out with the record, but we also have always wanted to host our own charity event concert. And it kind of gave us the opportunity off of the road to sit down and plan an event of this scale that we normally wouldn't have because we're typically on the road as much as we are.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the charity event because it benefits an organization that is near and dear to my heart.
Absolutely. Yeah. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. We wanted to, I think that cancer kind of affects probably just about everybody in one way, shape, or form. Somebody has a story or a loved one in their life that's been affected by this, and we thought they were a great cause to give back to. And we just wanted to host it in kind of our own backyard in Spearfish at Black Hill State University. They've been awesome partners for us. Everybody that we're working with has been so gracious in donating so much time and assets and everything to help us put this event together and raise as much money as we possibly can for this great cause.
Yeah. So the Wild Feathers are coming from Nashville and also this lineup of local artists, quite a few who have been here on In the Moment with us. Tell us who's all going to participate in this event in June.
Absolutely. It's the Judd Hoos Charity Jam, so you better believe mm-hmm. Judd Hoos will be there playing the show. We couldn't help ourselves there. But we also have a lot of our other friends, Brian Lowry from Fargo, North Dakota, Denim from Sioux Falls. Camp Comfort is based out of the Black Hills. They're going to be performing as well. And then just a slew of other local and regional artists that are coming together and donating their time and performances.
All right. And you're also on tour. So tell us a little bit, and then we're going to get to some new music. But quickly, people can go where to find out about where you're going to be at this summer.
Yeah, judhoos.com. We got a big tab right at the top that says tour. You can check it out. I think we've added close to 40 to 50 shows between June and September. So we're going to try to make up for as much time as we can, all the lost time we had in the past year.
All right. We'll put a link up on our website, but it's JUDDHOOS because we're on the radio. So sometimes people say, how do I spell Judd Hoos? There it is. We're going to close out our hour with new music from the album Not Alone. What do you want to tell us, Andy, about this song that we'll hear, and then we'll say thank you?
Yeah. Which one are you thinking about playing?
It's Numb. It's Numb. Yeah.
Numb?
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So this song kind of got started out. I wrote it about my commute into work, actually, and it was kind of written, it's fictional, you know, it's a story, not autobiographical or anything, but just about a story of struggling with your own mental health and just kind of overcoming and it's just a really special song. We're really excited to be rolling out a music video for it here pretty soon as well.
I look forward to that. Look forward to having you back on the program. Andy Young, guitarist for the band Judd Hoos, thanks so much for being here with us. Have a great tour.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
We will leave you with Numb by Judd Hoos. For Steve Zwemke and Chris Loughry and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening. She missed her shot to be someone. She's gone numb. And wonders where it had begun. Still in mind, her time to shine's completely come and gone. She's gone. Her last night bad, the darkness has a way of waging war. Nothing hurts like the pain you feel when you feel nothing at all. She'll hold her breath the best up to the point of being deprived. Just to feel her body help her mind that she's alive. She's gone. Come to grips with where she missed her shot to be someone. She's gone numb. Wonders where it had begun. Still mind her time to shine's completely come and gone. She's gone numb. Someday she's fine, but most of the time still tortured by. Come to grips with where she missed her shot to be someone. She's gone numb.